call him back. He did. Bernstein read to him from his notes. Robert Odle had removed documents during the weekend of the Watergate arrests and perhaps destroyed some. Somebody, not necessarily Odle, had destroyed memos describing the wiretapped conversations of Democratic Party officials. Robert Mardian and Fred LaRue, beginning on June 19th, had directed the response to the bugging and were aware of the destruction of some records. It was part of the response. LaRue and Mardian had told CRP employees to avoid certain areas when questioned by investigators, particularly as they related to any records that might have been destroyed. Mitchell had selected Mardian and LaRue to take charge of CRP's response. The agent was furious. There was only one place the information could have come from, and that was the 302s, he said. It was against the law for Bernstein to have these files, or copies of them. And if the Post published a story so clearly based on the 302s, the agent would attempt to have Bernstein and Woodward subpoenaed in order to turn over all documents belonging to the government. It was an odd confirmation, but that's what it was. How substantial were the allegations? The agent wouldn't say. That was the trouble with the 302s, Bernstein knew. They were raw reports, unevaluated, unsubstantiated. Anybody could say any damn thing to the FBI, and it went straight into the 302. Facts, fourth-hand information, personal suspicions, gripes. Using a 302 as the sole basis for a story was unthinkable. The agent's indirect confirmation on Odle, Mardian, and LaRue, and on the destruction of records in general, meant only that the FBI had received the same raw information the reporters had. It wasn't enough. Bernstein called Sloan, but he was too busy to see them or even to talk on the phone. Bernstein could call back later in the day. While Woodward made the day's telephone checks, which often took hours, Bernstein began a draft of a story. Bernstein had become convinced that a tangible accounting could be assembled which would prove that an organized attempt had been made to conceal the facts of Watergate. Woodward was skeptical. He wasn't alone. Rosenfeld had called Woodward into his office a few days earlier to tell him that Bernstein's thinking frequently moved one step ahead of the facts. Bernstein's theories were often right, Rosenfeld said, and he didn't wish to discourage him. But you've got to make sure that none of that gets into the paper unless it's fully supported, Rosenfeld implored. Bernstein's draft reported that John Mitchell's principal associates at CRP, Mardian and LaRue, had directed a massive house cleaning, in which records were destroyed and staff members were instructed to close ranks in response to the Watergate arrests. And that the house cleaning had immediately followed Mitchell's personal selection of LaRue and Mardian to direct the committee's response. The draft described some of what had gone on at CRP during those days after the break-in at the Watergate. The wholesale destruction of documents, wiretap memos, the single-sheet accounting of the secret fund, including the withdrawals by Porter, Magruder, and Liddy, and as many as 7 ledger books listing campaign contributors and the amounts they gave before April 7th was accomplished. Mardian and LaRue had begun a search for incriminating evidence on June 19th, and the relevant records no longer existed by the time the FBI began its examination of CRP's files. Robert Odle had spent the weekend after the Watergate break-in taking an inventory of the committee's files and removing records. After the destruction of the records, he had been assigned by CRP to provide the FBI with the documents it requested. Further, that Mardian, LaRue, and the committee's lawyers had advised certain individuals to stay away from certain areas when questioned by the FBI, the prosecutors, and the grand jury. Sloan was quoted anonymously as saying that campaign workers were never told in so many words, "Don't talk." It was always "hold ranks" or "keep the ship together." And still further, that other employees had said their superiors suggested specific responses to questions that would be asked by investigators. FBI interviews were conducted in the presence of either the committee's lawyers or Mardian. Several employees with knowledge of damaging information were suddenly promoted in the weeks immediately following the Watergate arrests. Employees of the committee had been forbidden to talk to the press without specific clearance. even so much as to state their job titles. One employee said she had been followed to a luncheon appointment with a reporter and had been interrogated afterward about their conversation. After Bernstein had finished, he reached Sloan by phone and read him the draft. Sloan confirmed virtually the entire story. Bernstein added a few details, including an account of Liddy's bad apple speech to his colleagues on the Monday after the break-in. Woodward and Bernstein took the draft to Rosenfeld. At 44, Rosenfeld had been a foreign editor of the New York Herald Tribune and the Washington Post. Brash and tough at times, he is extremely skillful at locating holes in stories written by his reporters. Since the week following the Watergate break-in, Rosenfeld had been the hard sell artist, persuading Bradley and the other senior editors, after satisfying himself, that the reporters had touched every base in their stories. From the day in 1970 when he had moved from the foreign desk to become Metropolitan editor, Rosenfeld's mission had been to raise the local staff from its second-class citizenship at the Post. Seizing on the potential of the Watergate story, he had fought for it to remain with the Metropolitan staff and had won, resisting attempts by the national editors to take over. Rosenfeld runs the Metropolitan staff, the Post's largest, like a football coach. He prods his players, letting them know that he has promised the front office results, pleading, yelling, cajoling, pacing, working his facial expressions for instant effects, anger, satisfaction, concern. He was born in pre-Nazi Berlin and came to New York City when he was 10. He made a successful effort to forget his German and speaks English without any trace of an accent. Rosenfeld went to work for the Herald Tribune after his graduation from Syracuse University and has always been an editor, never a reporter. He was inclined to worry that too many reporters on the Metropolitan staff were incompetent and thought even the best reporters could be saved from self-destruction only by the skills of an editor. His natural distrust of reporters was particularly acute on the Watergate story, where the risks were very great. And he was in the uncomfortable position of having to trust Bernstein and Woodward more than he had ever trusted any reporters. Aware that much of the story was out of his hands, he tried to exercise what control he could. He hovered around the reporters' typewriters as they wrote, passed them questions as they talked on the phone to sources, demanded to be briefed after they hung up or returned from a meeting. Now, gulping down antacid tablets, Rosenfeld grilled Bernstein and Woodward to find out how solid this latest story was. He was reassured by Bernstein's conversation with the FBI agent. At least the FBI had the same allegations on paper. Rosenfeld always felt better when he knew that somewhere, no matter how inaccessible, there was a piece of paper that could support a story. And it was a dangerous story. The Post was, in effect, making its own charges, not only against the campaign officials, but also concerning the thoroughness of the FBI and grand jury investigations. The charges were, in some ways, more serious than those handed down in the indictment 4 days earlier. His interrogation completed, Rosenfeld approved the story. Bernstein called CRP for its ritual comment. The notation, "insert denial," was marked between paragraphs 2 and 3, right after the descriptions of Mardian and LaRue as the head house cleaners. The committee's press office didn't respond for more than an hour and a half. The reporters were certain that there would be at least some assertion that Fred LaRue and Robert Mardian had been models of probity in their efforts to re-elect the president. Bernstein had a healthy fear of Mardian, having spent several years covering the New Left, the anti-war movement, demonstrations, riots, freaks, flower children, druggies, crazies, old and new radicals. During the time Mardian was head of the Internal Security Division of the Justice Department. It was the division in charge of government wiretapping, and Mardian had supervised the unsuccessful prosecutions in many of the administration's celebrated conspiracy or political trials, in which defendants and lawyers alike had been placed under electronic and other means of surveillance. Finally, Van Shumway called with the CRP's response to the story. "The sources of the Washington Post are a fountain of misinformation," he said. Bernstein waited, That was the whole statement. Because the story's implications were the opposite of the message contained in the indictments, Bernstein and Woodward expected it would receive considerable attention. But, for the most part, the nation's major news outlets either ignored it or focused on denials by Mardian, who refused to talk to the Post. The Los Angeles Times quoted Mardian's description of the Post story as the biggest lot of crap I have ever heard in my life. The Washington Star News carried three paragraphs on the end of another Watergate story and quoted Mardian as calling the Post story a lie and denying that he or other campaign officials had conducted a house cleaning to destroy documents. Clark McGregor told an audience in New Hampshire that it was important the press not discuss this Watergate in such great detail as to possibly prejudice any trial. On public television's 30 Minutes With, Richard Kleindienst was questioned by Elizabeth Drew, the Washington correspondent of The Atlantic, about the Post story. The Attorney General didn't know if any records had been destroyed. He hadn't any idea why anybody at CRP would want to tear up documents. If Mardian and LaRue had destroyed records, he said, an obstruction of justice might indeed have taken place. Chapter 5. Bernstein and Woodward thought that signs were beginning to point unmistakably toward John Mitchell, former Attorney General of the United States. Since his original declaration of CRP's innocence on June 18th, Mitchell had been the subject of almost continual inquiry by the reporters, and they now knew that the prevailing opinion of the committee was that Mitchell was involved. After his resignation as Nixon's campaign manager, Mitchell had continued to help direct the re-election effort. A CRP official had told the reporters that Mitchell helped draft many of the non-denial denials which were being issued in response to their stories. Mitchell had been questioned by the grand jury. And there was his wife. Since June 22nd, when she had telephoned Helen Thomas of United Press International to say that she was sick of the whole operation and had threatened to leave her husband, Martha Mitchell's outbursts had been a bizarre aspect of the Watergate affair. 3 days after that initial call, she had telephoned again to declare that she was a political prisoner. "I'm not going to stand for all these dirty things that go on. If you could see me, you wouldn't believe it. I'm black and blue." The Mitchells had moved back to New York and were living at the Essex House on Central Park South. Woodward took the last night flight to New York on September 21st, hoping to catch Mrs. Mitchell at home the next morning after her husband had left for the offices of Mudge, Rose, Guthrie, and Alexander, the law firm in which he and Richard Nixon had both been partners. At 9 the next morning, Woodward asked the clerk for the room number of J.N. Mitchell. No one was registered under that name. He went to a telephone booth down the street and called the Essex House. "Give me the room where the Mitchells are staying at once. Hurry," he said. "Room 710, the switchboard operator said, ringing the extension. A man answered the phone. He asked who was calling, and Woodward identified himself as a Post reporter. "Mrs. Mitchell couldn't come to the phone," the man said, and hung up. A few minutes later, Woodward took the elevator to the 7th floor and walked to room 710, which was the Marriott suite, according to a brass plate on the white door. He moved on to the end of the hall and knocked on a door. No one answered, which was exactly what Woodward hoped. He could stand in front of the door all day, if necessary, as if waiting for someone to open it. He had talked to Mrs. Mitchell once in 1971, when she had called him after he had written a story about the smokestacks of a huge generating plant that were polluting the exclusive air in the vicinity of the Watergate. Checking city records, Woodward had discovered that among the formal complaints was one from Martha Mitchell, Watergate resident. He had tried to call her before he wrote the story to ask if she knew that the offending smokestacks were fed by the monster engines which supplied electrical power to the White House and the Justice Department. But he couldn't reach her. Mrs. Mitchell had called him the morning the story appeared, and Woodward had found her refreshing. "Honey," she said, "she didn't care if her John and Mr. President had to work by candlelight. She had learned enough back in Pine Bluff, Arkansas, to know that human beings should not be subjected to direct hits from anybody's waist. That had been almost a year ago. She had been considered something of a truth-teller in Washington, though a little wiggy, perhaps. Now, Woodward thought, Martha Mitchell was becoming the Greek chorus of the Watergate drama, sounding her warnings to all who would hear. Woodward had waited in the hallway for about 20 minutes when the Mitchell's security guard, a large black man, left the suite and took the elevator down. Woodward went down to a telephone booth in the lobby and called room 710. Martha Mitchell answered. She sounded jovial and happy for the chance to chat. They talked about Washington, politics, the upcoming election, Manhattan. The operator broke in, saying it would take another 5 cents to keep talking. "I wouldn't want Katie Graham to spend another nickel on me," Mrs. Mitchell said. Woodward popped a quarter into the payphone. But she was starting to sound anxious and said she had to run. Woodward took the elevator back to the 7th floor. After a few minutes, some hotel maids knocked on the door of 710. Martha Mitchell let them in. Woodward raced to 710 as the door was shut and knocked. Mrs. Mitchell, probably expecting another maid, opened it again. She was wearing a print blouse, blue slacks, and white sandals. "I'm so embarrassed," she said. "You caught me with grease on my face." During a 15-minute chat, with vacuum cleaners whirring in the background, Mrs. Mitchell said she planned to write a book about her experiences in Washington, and that she was much happier making my family a non-political entity. The subject of Watergate made her visibly nervous. Each time Woodward raised a question about it, she said, "I don't know. You tell me." Or, "That comes out in the book I'm writing." And then she began fidgeting. She would not elaborate on her earlier pronouncements, made by phone to reporters in the middle of the night, about dirty politics or this cops and robbers business. She would talk about the upcoming election, though. She predicted that President Nixon would win the election by the biggest landslide in the history of the country, getting 99.9% of the vote. "I think there shouldn't be an election. If you ask me, the president should have a 7-year term and boom, then put him out. They start running again after they're in office 2 years. I don't care which party you're talking about." Woodward wrote a brief story for the Post-Style section, but it had been a wasted trip. The Sloan's daughter, Melissa Madison Sloan, was born on September 25th at Washington's Georgetown Hospital. Bernstein talked by phone with Hugh Sloan the next day. He sounded relaxed, his mind far away from the troubles of Watergate and CRP. Bernstein had been trying to see Sloan again for days, but on the morning after the birth of his daughter, even mentioning Watergate seemed wrong. They chatted for a few minutes about the baby, her mother. She was understandably ecstatic, Sloan said, and the grandparents, who would be coming into town that week. Perhaps sometime Sloan could find a few minutes to sit down with the reporters, Bernstein suggested. Sloan said he'd try and suggested that Bernstein call back in a couple of days. That afternoon, Bernstein debated with himself for a while, then called a florist and ordered flowers sent to Georgetown Hospital. He was concerned that his gesture might be misunderstood. There was no denying that his motivation was touched by self-interest. But there was also the fact that he felt warmly toward the Sloanes, especially Mrs. Sloan. He hoped the flowers wouldn't arrive while Maurice Stans or one of their friends from the White House was there. 2 days later, Bernstein called Sloan. Sloan might have some time the next morning, but he really didn't see how he could be very helpful. Well, if the reporters had some information that he could confirm or steer them away from, that would be all right. He wouldn't be violating any trust in doing that. Could they check with him early the next morning? Bernstein called him before 8. Sloan said he had to clean up the house before his in-laws arrived, but if the reporters could get out to McLean quickly, they could stop by for a few minutes. Sloan was dressed in sport clothes, and, except for the broom he was holding in his hand, he still looked like the Princeton undergraduate he had once been. He shook hands with Woodward, who immediately volunteered to help clean up the house. Sloan declined the offer and offered coffee. A framed Christmas card picturing the President and Mrs. Nixon at home in the White House hung near the kitchen table. There was a scrawled message from the Chief and First Lady. In the living room were more mementos. Another Christmas card. White House matchbooks with the presidential seal. Bernstein lit a cigarette and pocketed one. Souvenirs from the 68 campaign. Sloan sat in a high-backed, upholstered chair, tapping his coffee cup lightly with his spoon as he talked, rarely sipping from the cup, his face drawn. He was shy. They were discussing Maurice Stans's office, who worked there, the lines of authority. Sloan was devoted to Stans. People who thought Stans would knowingly have anything to do with political espionage didn't really know the secretary, he said. Stans was in anguish. He had allowed himself to be maligned in the press to protect the political people. He had never known what the money withdrawn by Liddy and Porter and Magruder was to be spent on. Did that mean that Stans had known of the outlays beforehand? Sloan hesitated. He was trying to plead Stans's case, and instead was getting him in deeper. The bookkeeper had refused to say whether Stans knew of the withdrawals when they took place. Bernstein tried playing devil's advocate, suggesting that Stans would have been derelict had he not asked to be kept informed of disbursals of money from his own safe. Sloan agreed. Then he said that Stans had given his approval before Liddy, Porter, and Magruder were authorized to make withdrawals from the fund, but that he had not given his authorization until after he had received assurances from the political managers of the campaign that they wanted the money dispersed. Who were these political managers? Sloan was uncomfortable with the question. It was enough to know that Stans had not acted on his own, he said. Woodward jumped at the opening. In other words, a group of people in the political management of the campaign had the ultimate authority to approve disbursements from the secret fund? That was right, Sloan said. But he didn't want to go into it any further. Get those names, and it will all be over, Bernstein was thinking. Sloan was more interested in talking about the Marty and LaRue story on CRP's house cleaning. He was curious about how the reporters had gotten their information. It was consistent with his own deductions, but he was surprised that anyone in a position to know things firsthand would have talked so explicitly. Bernstein's stomach began a slow dance of panic. He had been under the impression that Sloan had confirmed almost the whole story on the basis of firsthand knowledge, not deduction. Other sources had confirmed the underpinning of the story, true, but much of it rested primarily on what Sloan had said, and now he seemed to be backing off. They went through the story again, handicapped by not having it in front of them. As they took it point by point, Woodward and Bernstein relaxed a bit. Very little, if anything, that Sloan had said before was deduction. He wasn't sure that he would have characterized all the specifics in the story as evidence of a house cleaning, but that was a matter for the reporter's judgment. He hadn't known much about Odell. That, however, was of small concern, because that information had come from somewhere else. Nothing in the story was at variance with what he understood to be true, Sloan said finally. The discussion kept moving around the edges of the secret fund. Was there any chance that the money had been authorized for legitimate activities, for routine intelligence-gathering projects? Such innocuous tasks as recording the opposition's speeches and clipping newspapers. To almost every question dealing with the fund, Sloan would answer that circumstances had forced him to assume the worst, and then would ask the reporters what they thought. He had been at the White House, at CRP, and had worked in campaigns before, but maybe they knew things that would cause him to redirect his thinking. They didn't. Their thinking was directed toward the political side of the committee, particularly John and Mitchell. Bernstein reminded Sloan of his remark that Mitchell had almost certainly known of the cash outlays from the secret fund. Was he one of those authorized, as Sloan had put it a few minutes earlier, to approve disbursements? Obviously, Sloan said. There were five people with authorizing authority over the fund, and Mitchell was one of them. Stans was another. Had Mitchell known of the disbursements that had gone to Magruder, Porter, and Liddy? Sloan nodded. But that was not proof Mitchell had known of the bugging. There was a remote possibility that the three had gone off on their own and spent the money on unauthorized projects, although Sloan doubted it. He was being careful. How had it worked? How had Mitchell exercised his authority over the fund? By voucher? It was a routine procedure, Sloan said. And in the context of a campaign with a budget of over $50 million, it had seemed insignificant at the time. When Sloan had first been approached for money, he had simply picked up the telephone and called Mitchell at the Justice Department. It only took a few seconds. Mitchell would tell him to give the money out. There had been a number of phone calls, beginning in 1971. The reporters avoided looking at each other. While he was Attorney General of the United States, John Mitchell had authorized the expenditure of campaign funds for apparently illegal activities against the political opposition. They wanted to be sure they had heard Sloan correctly. They had. Not only was Mitchell one of the five people with control over the fund, but he had exercised it frequently. Indeed, initially, he had been the sole person to authorize the expenditures. Later, the authority had been passed to others. Magruder was among them, said Sloan. The bookkeeper's account of the fund was beginning to make sense. She had said that about six people were involved, but only three that she knew of, Porter, Liddy, and Magruder, had received money. The others, she had said, had simply gotten phone calls. It was all coming together. The other names were those who could authorize payments. They had been called by Sloan before the cash was handed out. Magruder had initially received money from the fund on Mitchell's authorization. Eventually, he had been given authority to approve payments to others as well. Mitchell, Stans, and Magruder. That left two others who could authorize the payments by Sloan's account. Were they also on the political side at CRP? Neither worked for the re-election committee, Sloan said. But he would go no further. Even aside from the names, the reporters still did not fully understand the purpose of the fund. Who else would have received cash from Stans's safe? Would they necessarily have known about the bugging? Sloan had no reason to believe the other recipients were involved or that the money they received had financed anything illegal or improper. Only Porter, Liddy, and Magruder had received large amounts of money. There were no comparable payments to others. How could Sloan be so sure that the money withdrawn by those three had been put to illegal or improper use, if the remainder of the money was spent legitimately? Again, Sloan said he was assuming the worst. But it was more than guesswork. He had heard a lot, seen a lot. Woodward, who had not met Sloan before, was impressed by his care and his unwillingness to mention the names of persons he had no reason to think had done anything wrong. Sloan's credentials as a source seemed impeccable. He was thoroughly committed to the re-election of Richard Nixon, and seemed convinced that the president had known nothing of the indiscretions committed by his campaign staff. And he seemed to understand how they had occurred. Overzealousness, overkill, a desire to leave nothing to chance in the effort to re-elect the president. He had seen it all at the White House. One breathed a rarefied air when one was in the president's service, and Sloan thought the White House might be involved in the bugging. The other two persons authorized to approve payments from the fund, were they members of the White House staff? Only one, said Sloan. The other was not an official in either the campaign or the administration, not a Washingtonian. The reporter suggested that only three persons at the White House seemed likely to have had control over the fund, H.R. Haldeman, Charles Colson, and John Ehrlichman. Their money was on Colson. Sloan shook his head. That wasn't the way Colson operated, he said. Chuck was too crafty, too careful to put himself in jeopardy that way. If it had been Colson, he would have done it through someone else, and that hadn't happened. The only reason the reporters had mentioned Ehrlichman was because of his high position at the White House. If Stans and Mitchell had had to be consulted before the money could be dispersed, someone of similar stature at the White House must have been involved. Ehrlichman had no major role in the campaign, as far as the reporters knew. Haldeman, because he was overseer of CRP, and because of his reputation, seemed the more logical choice. Haldeman, known to the reporters by little more than his reputation for autocratic control of the White House staff, was the president's eyes and ears on the campaign, Sloan confirmed. Through his political aide, Gordon Strachan, Haldeman was kept informed of every major decision made at CRP. Magruder was Haldeman's man at the committee, installed there to make sure that John Mitchell did not run the committee without proper input from the White House. Still, Sloan would not say yes or no. But he said nothing to steer the reporters away from Haldeman, as he had with Colson. They were almost convinced it was Haldeman. That left one more person, someone who worked for neither the White House nor CRP. Murray Choetner? No, said Sloan. Bernstein threw out a name Woodward had never heard before. Herbert Kalmbach, President Nixon's personal lawyer. It was a guess. Sloan looked surprised. Bernstein had remembered reading a piece in the New York Times the previous February that referred to Kalmbach as Nixon's personal attorney on the West Coast, and said that prospective clients who had business with the government couldn't talk to him for less than $10,000. It related that his law practice had mushroomed, and that he was second only to Maurice Stans on Nixon's national fundraising team. He was secretary of the Nixon Foundation, which was planning the Nixon Library. The story said he also worked frequently on private projects for the president and the White House. Sloan said he didn't want to get into a guessing game. The reporters couldn't tell whether this was because Kalmbach was a lucky guess or a ridiculous one. That could wait. Haldeman was the important name, if it was Haldeman. The reporters had already helped themselves to 3 cups of coffee, going back to the kitchen to refill their cups. Sloan had been glancing at his watch and reminding them that he had to clean up the house. They had been there for more than 2 hours. It would be senseless to overstay their welcome. They tried once more on Haldeman. If it was not Haldeman, then why not say so? I just don't want to get into it, said Sloan, doing nothing to shake the reporters' belief that they were on the right track. After a few more minutes of general talk about the campaign, the three of them walked to the door. Someday maybe you'll be president, Woodward told Sloan. Bernstein was astonished at the remark, for it didn't sound as if it had been made lightly. Woodward had meant it as a form of flattery, but there was an element of respect in it, and more, a hope that Sloan would survive the mess. It was past noon when the reporters got to the office. Woodward placed a quick call to a source working on the federal investigation. By then, the reporters checked regularly with a half dozen persons in the Justice Department and FBI who were sometimes willing to confirm information that had been obtained elsewhere. The sources rarely went further, often not that far. This time, Woodward was lucky. Sloan had told the whole story of the fund to investigators. So had the bookkeeper. Mitchell, Stans, Magruder. That was right. The source wouldn't volunteer the names of the other two persons who had controlled the fund. It was certain that the money had paid for espionage against the Democrats. Whether it had financed the Watergate operation was unclear, depending on whom you believed. The details about the fund's operation were as described by Sloan and the bookkeeper, he said. Haldeman? The source wouldn't say. A few minutes later, they met with Bradley, Simons, Rosenfeld, and Sussman in Bradley's office, a comfortable carpeted room with a picture window looking out into the newsroom, a modern oval rosewood table instead of a desk, and a black leather couch. During discussions in his office, Bradley frequently picked up an undersized sponge rubber basketball from the table and tossed it toward a hoop attached by suction cups to the picture window. The gesture was indicative both of the editor's short attention span and of a studied informality. There was an alluring combination of aristocrat and commoner about Bradley. Boston Brahmin, Harvard, the World War II Navy, press attaché at the U.S. Embassy in Paris, police beat reporter, news magazine political reporter, and Washington bureau chief of Newsweek. Simons, as restrained as Bradley could be hard-charging and obstreperous, liked to tell of watching Bradley grind his cigarettes out in a demi-tasse cup during a formal dinner party. Bradley was one of the few persons who could pull that kind of thing off and leave the hostess saying how charming he was. Hardly unaware of his image, Bradley even cultivated it. He delighted in displaying his street savvy, telling a reporter to get his ass moving and talk to some real cops, not lieutenants and captains behind a desk, then rising to greet some visiting dignitary from Le Monde or L'Express in formal, flawless French, complete with a peck on each cheek. Bradley listened attentively as Woodward ran down what details the reporters had about the secret fund, its control by Mitchell and Stans, and the probability of Haldeman's authority over it as well. Bradley focused on Mitchell, and the context in which Sloan had described Mitchell's involvement with the fund. Bernstein and Woodward thought they were on the verge of finding out the names of all five persons who controlled the secret fund, and perhaps more about the individual transactions. Then they planned to write what would be a definitive account, who controlled the money, and precisely how it related to Watergate. They started to explain their plan to Bradley, and noticed that he was doodling on a sheet of paper on his desk, a sign that he was becoming a trifle impatient. He interrupted with a wave of his hand, then got to the point. "Listen, fellas, are you certain on Mitchell?" A pause. "Absolutely certain." He stared at each of the reporters as they nodded. "Can you write it now?" They hesitated, then said they could. The reporters understood Bradley's philosophy. A daily newspaper can't wait for the definitive account of events. Bradley stood up. "Well then, let's do it." And, he presumed aloud, the reporters realized the implications of such a story. That John Mitchell was not someone to be trifled with? That now they were playing real hardball? Bradley wasn't interrogating them. He was administering an oath. They nodded, aware that they were about to take a bigger step than either of them had ever taken. "Good story, good story," Simon said, repeating an office cliché, and they all laughed. "Go," Bradley said, waving everybody out of his office. Bernstein was disappointed to see the meeting end. The editor had pushed his left sleeve up, and Bernstein had seen a tattoo of a rooster. Bernstein momentarily forgot about Watergate. Bradley, whom he regarded with an unhealthy imbalance of respect, fear, anger, and self-pity. Bradley didn't understand him, he had decided long before, was always amazing him. He wished he had gotten a better look at the tattoo. Writing the story took surprisingly little time. It moved from Bernstein's typewriter to Woodward's, then to Rosenfeld and Sussman, and finally to Bradley and Simons. Only minor changes were made. By 6 p.m., it was in the composing room. John N. Mitchell, while serving as U.S. Attorney General, personally controlled a secret Republican fund that was used to gather information about the Democrats, according to sources involved in the Watergate investigation. Beginning in the spring of 1971, almost a year before he left the Justice Department to become President Nixon's campaign manager on March 1st, Mitchell personally approved withdrawals from the fund, several reliable sources have told the Washington Post. Four persons other than Mitchell were later authorized to approve payments from the secret fund, the sources said. Two of them were identified as former Secretary of Commerce Maurice H. Stans, now finance chairman of the president's campaign, and Jeb Stuart Magruder, manager of the Nixon campaign before Mitchell took over and now a deputy director of the campaign. The other two, according to the sources, are a high White House official now involved in the campaign and a campaign aide outside of Washington. The rest of the story dealt with how the fund operated. Sloan's phone calls to Mitchell, withdrawals by Liddy, Porter, and Magruder, and the GAO's determination that even the existence of the fund was apparently illegal because the expenditures had not been reported. The Watergate grand jury's investigation did not establish that the intelligence gathering fund directly financed the illegal eavesdropping, the story said. According to the Post's sources, the primary purpose of the secret fund was to finance widespread intelligence gathering operations against the Democrats. Bernstein called CRP for the rights of denial and reached Powell Moore. Half an hour later, Moore called back with the committee's response. I think your sources are bad. They're providing misinformation. We're not going to comment beyond that, he said. He couldn't be budged to discuss the specifics. Bernstein remained at the Post that night to pursue the apparent Haldeman connection and read the clips on Herbert Kalmbach. At about 11 p.m., he got another call from Moore, who had talked to John Mitchell and had a new statement. There is absolutely no truth to the charges in the Post story. Neither Mr. Mitchell nor Mr. Stans has any knowledge of any disbursement from an alleged fund, as described by the Post, and neither of them controlled any committee expenditures while serving as government officials. Bernstein studied the statement and underlined the soft spots. The charges on the Post story. What charges? Disbursement from an alleged fund, as described by the Post. There was no denial of the fund's existence, or that money had been dispersed, only of the way it was described. Neither of them controlled any committee expenditures. Technically correct. Sloan had controlled the expenditures. Mitchell and Stans had only approved them. It was the cleverest denial yet, Bernstein told Moore, and tried to go over it with him. Moore wouldn't play. The new statement would be duly recorded, along with Moore's refusal to elaborate, Bernstein told Moore. If the Nixon committee would not respond, maybe Mitchell would, he added, telling Moore he would try to reach the attorney general. He wrote an insert on the new statement and dialed the number of the Essex House in New York. He asked for room 710. Mitchell answered. Bernstein recognized the voice and began scribbling notes. He wanted to get everything down on paper, including his own questions. Moments after the call had ended, Bernstein began to type it out. In his agitated state, it was difficult to hit the right keys. Mitchell.
Yes?
Bernstein, after identifying himself. Sir, I'm sorry to bother you at this hour, but we're running a story in tomorrow's paper that, in effect, says that you controlled secret funds at the committee while you were attorney general.
Mitchell. Jesus! You said that? What does it say?
Bernstein. I'll read you the first few paragraphs. He got as far as the third. Mitchell responded,
Jesus!
Every few words.
Mitchell. All that crap, you're putting it in the paper? It's all been denied. Katie Graham's gonna get her tit caught in a big fat ringer if that's published. Good Christ, that's the most sickening thing I ever heard.
Bernstein. Sir, I'd like to ask you a few questions about...
Mitchell. What time is it?
Bernstein. 11:30, I'm sorry to call so late.
Mitchell. 11:30. 11:30 when?
Bernstein. 11:30 at night.
Mitchell. Oh.
Bernstein. The committee has issued a statement about the story, but I'd like to ask you a few questions about the specifics of what the story contains.
Mitchell. Did the committee tell you to go ahead and publish that story? You fellas got a great ball game going. As soon as you're through paying Ed Williams...
Edward Bennett Williams, principal attorney for the Washington Post.
And the rest of those fellas, we're going to do a story on all of you.
Bernstein. Sir, about the story.
Mitchell. Call my law office in the morning.
He hung up. For Bernstein, the only constant had been an adrenal feeling that began with Mitchell's first, Jesus, some sort of primal scream. As the cry of Jesus was repeated, Bernstein had perceived the excruciating depth of Mitchell's hurt. For a moment, he had been afraid that Mitchell might die on the telephone. And for the first time, Mitchell was flesh and blood, not Nixon's campaign manager, the shadow of Kent State, Carswell's keeper, the high sheriff of Law and Order, the jowled heavy of Watergate. Bernstein's skin felt prickly. Mitchell had escaped indictment by the grand jury, which would keep his secrets, but the reporters had said the words out loud. Though using the neutral language of a reporter's trade, they had called John Mitchell a crook. Bernstein did not savor the moment. Mitchell's tone was so filled with hate and loathing that Bernstein had felt threatened. Bernstein was shocked at his language, his ugliness.
"Did the committee tell you to go ahead and publish that story? We're going to do a story on all of you."
Mitchell had said "we." Once the election was over, they could do almost anything they damn well pleased, and get away with it. Bernstein was determined to get Mitchell's remarks into the paper. When he had finished typing, Bernstein briefed Bill Brady, the Knight Metropolitan editor, and proposed a 2-paragraph insert. Brady, who had been rewrite man for the old Washington Times-Herald when it was bought by the Post in 1954, was perhaps the most unflappable person in the Post newsroom. But he had never heard anything like this one, and asked if Bernstein was sure he had been talking to John Mitchell. Assured, Brady shook his head. As Bernstein had expected, Brady was not about to render a decision on how to handle Mitchell's commentary. Bernstein reached Bradley at home in bed. The editor was stunned.
"Do you know what John Mitchell just said?" he asked his wife. "Was Mitchell drunk?"
Bernstein said he couldn't tell.
There was no question that Bernstein had properly identified himself.
None.
Mitchell had understood he was talking to a reporter.
Definitely.
And Bernstein had good notes?
Right. Bradley asked Bernstein to read him the proposed insert for the third time, while he considered calling Mrs. Graham. He decided the call wasn't necessary.
"Leave everything in but her tit," Bradley instructed,
"and tell the desk I said it's okay."
He rejected a mild appeal from Bernstein to run the quotation intact.
"People would get the message," Bradley said.
The phone rang about 5 minutes later. Powell Moore wanted to know if the committee's second statement had made the paper. Bernstein said it had, as well as Mitchell's additional comments on the matter. Moore sounded worried. What had the Attorney General said? Bernstein read him the insert and told him it was already being set in type.
"Oh," said Moore.
Bernstein went home, his head full of disturbing visions. He had been there for only a few minutes when the phone rang. It was Moore. Bernstein started scribbling.
"Moore. Carl, are you sure you didn't catch Mr. Mitchell at a bad moment?"
Bernstein.
"I don't know."
Moore.
"You caught him at an unguarded moment. He's been a cabinet member and so forth. He doesn't want to show up in print like that."
Bernstein.
"I just reported what he said."
Moore.
"If his composure is not guarded, is it fair to him to hold him accountable for what he said? I'm wondering if it's totally fair to him. He goes to bed early, you know. Did he sound sleepy?"
Bernstein. "I couldn't tell. But I know that you fellows hold me accountable for what I write and what I say, so I don't think it's unreasonable to expect any less of Mr. Mitchell. He's dealt with the press before."
Moore. "Carl, I don't want anything printed that was said in a moment when the average person is not fully alert because he was awakened in the middle of the night."
Bernstein.
"What time did you talk to him?"
Moore.
"It was a while ago, probably around 9. Carl, is it too late to get that out of the paper?"
Bernstein.
"It's in there now, I think. The only way to get it out would be to talk to my editors. It was their judgment that it should be used, and I certainly concur."
Moore.
"Who would I talk to get it out? Is Bill Brady there?"
Bernstein.
"No. I would think that to get something out, you'd have to talk to Bradley."
Moore.
"I certainly don't want to make an independent decision to talk to Ben Bradley. Let me get back to you."
5 minutes later, Moore called again and asked how he could reach the editor. Bernstein said he should call the Post switchboard in 5 minutes. Then he called Bradley himself and told him to expect Moore's call. Always the southern gentleman, Moore called Bernstein back a few minutes later to tell him that Bradley had refused to kill the insert. Bradley, imitating Moore's drawl, later recalled that Moore asked him, "Was I sure this was a wise thing to do because we woke up the Attorney General probably late in the morning, and he wasn't having all his thoughts collected?" And I remember saying, "Which just boils down to the question, Mr. Moore, of whether he said it or not, and whether the Washington Post reporter identified himself as a reporter. And if he did that, all my requisites have been satisfied." At the post the next morning, Mrs. Graham asked Bernstein if he had any more messages for her. The night of October 4th, Woodward got home at about 11. The phone was ringing as he stepped in the door. Ace. It was Bill Brady. The night editor calls all the young reporters Ace. Brady had called Woodward Ace the second night he worked at the Post, and Woodward's head had swelled for several hours until he heard Brady address a notorious office incompetent by the same title. Ace, said Brady. The L.A. Times is running some long interview with a fellow named Baldwin. Woodward groaned and said he'd be right in. Alfred C. Baldwin III had seemed for a time to be one of the keys to Watergate. The reporters had learned of him while making some routine checks. Bernstein had been told that a former FBI agent had participated in the Watergate operation, that he had informed investigators that Democratic headquarters had been under electronic surveillance for about 3 weeks before the arrests, and that memos of the wiretapped conversations had been transcribed and sent directly to CRP. The man had also said he had infiltrated the Vietnam veterans against the war on orders from McCord. On September 11th, Bernstein and Woodward had written a story about the participation of such a former FBI agent. A week later, with help from the bookkeeper, they had identified him as Baldwin, a 35-year-old law school graduate who had worked as chief of security for a trucking firm before becoming a CRP employee paid in $100 bills. Baldwin was the government's chief witness, the insider who was spilling the whole story. He seemed to have unimaginable secrets to tell, and reporters were in line to hear them. Woodward had joined the queue. He began making regular phone calls to Baldwin's lawyer, John Casidento, a Democratic state legislator from New Haven, Connecticut. "We've got hundreds of requests for interviews, hundreds," Casidento had told Woodward. "Everyone wants to talk to Al. There are two Los Angeles Times reporters camped out there. Al's getting no peace. He's followed. Ugly fuckers, you reporters. Thank God you're not pestering us." Taking that hint, Woodward said that he and Bernstein wouldn't join the herd. "Fine," Casinetto said cozily. "We'll let you know if Al has anything to say. You'll get the first call." Several days later, Casinetto called Woodward back. "Hey, Al needs some money. Everyone's offering him money for his story. Just want to let you know in case you want to enter the bidding. It was rumored that a major magazine had offered $5,000 for Baldwin's first-person account." Woodward explained that the Post never paid for news. "Okay, okay. I'm sorry you don't care about the story," said Casidento. "We have other offers." Woodward started to say that the Post cared very much about the story, but Casidento had hung up. Woodward and Bernstein told the editors about the invitation to bid on Baldwin's story. "I bid this," Bradley said, and raised the middle finger of his right hand. 2 weeks later, and without paying a penny, the Los Angeles Times had gotten the story that brought Woodward back to his desk the night of October 4th. Baldwin's first-person account of the bugging operation, told to Times reporter Jack Nelson, was a vivid description of a raid on the Democratic National Headquarters and of the men who had participated in it. From the Howard Johnson Motor Hotel across the street from the Watergate, Baldwin had monitored conversations of Democrats' phone calls. McCord had told him he would be doing the same thing at the Democratic convention in Miami. When hired, he had been handed a gun belonging to Fred LaRue. He told of an aborted attempt to break into McGovern headquarters and bug it. Gordon Liddy had suggested shooting out a streetlight to facilitate the entry. Baldwin described a brief stint guarding Martha Mitchell, and he related Howard Hunt's panic as he had rushed into the Howard Johnson at 2:30 a.m. on June 17th and watched the police lead five of his hirelings from the Watergate. Bernstein and Woodward had been aced out. The story was a major break, not just because it contained a great deal of new information, but because it made the Watergate operation and the siege mentality behind it real. "I would like to have had that one," Bradley said the next day. He wasn't harsh, but he was grimacing, clutching his arms as he spoke, moving them quickly from side to side like a running halfback. "Egos are tender in this business," Bradley said months later. "You massage them, don't deflate them. I can't go out and take notes for someone. I'm removed, and sometimes it frustrates the hell out of me. I can't kick ass for getting scooped, but I do let it be known that I feel let down and that I hate it. Just hate it. Don't forget that I hate it." In his 5-hour taped interview with Jack Nelson, Baldwin hadn't provided the names of any individual who might have seen the wiretap memos. But 2 weeks before the Los Angeles Times interview, Bernstein had been told by a Democratic Party investigator that Baldwin had named 2 persons he thought had received them. Robert Odle, Jeb Magruder's intensely nervous aide-de-camp at both the White House and CRP, and William E. Timmons, assistant to the President for Congressional Relations and chief White House liaison to CRP for the Republican National Convention. Baldwin had seen McCord addressing the memos. There was a third recipient, Baldwin is alleged to have said, someone whose first name sounded like a last name. Shown a list of CRP officials by federal investigators, Baldwin had picked the name of J. Glenn Seedham, the man who had shared an office with Gordon Liddy. But, Bernstein was told, Baldwin hadn't been certain about Seedham. Bernstein suggested to Woodward that they write a story saying that Baldwin had named Odle and Timmons, and describing how he picked Seedham's name. Bernstein called a Justice Department source who confirmed the details. Woodward agreed to go ahead. The story would be a significant advance on the Los Angeles Times account. It ran on October 6th. There were no denunciations from CRP or the White House. But the report was incorrect, and the decision to rush it into print was a mistake. Weeks later, Woodward and Bernstein learned that the initial FBI report had not made it clear whether the memos Baldwin had seen were of the wiretap conversations or were merely routine security memos. Eventually, the reporters became convinced that they were routine memos, which had nothing to do with wiretapping. 3 men had been wronged. They had been unfairly accused on the front page of the Washington Post, the hometown newspaper of their families, neighbors, and friends. Odle complained to the prosecutors. "He was almost in tears," one of them said later. The stigma of Watergate stayed with him, though not solely because of the story, and he had great difficulty obtaining a job. In 1973, he was hired by the Department of Agriculture as a consultant, but he was soon fired when his name continued to figure in the investigation. Timmons was dejected about the Post allegations, and his wife had wanted him to quit his job on the White House staff. Only after a long conversation with the president had he decided to stay on. Chapter 6. The night of September 28th, Bernstein had been taking some good-natured complaining from the copy desk about his penchant for making late-night fixes or changes in his stories. He wasn't displeased when the exercise was interrupted by the phone. The caller introduced himself as a government lawyer who had nothing to do with the Watergate investigation. He said he might have some information that might or might not have something to do with the things Bernstein and Woodward had been writing about. Such calls were becoming more frequent, though most of the tips the reporters received were requests that the Post pursue theories about the deaths of John Kennedy, Mary Jo Kopechne, Martin Luther King, and others. As for tips related to Watergate, they had checked out dozens which had proven to be either inconsequential or without foundation. They had been dismayed at the lack of first-rate information reaching them via mail or telephone tips from strangers. Jack Anderson's network of anonymous bureaucratic sources was legendary, and big, ongoing stories, particularly scandals, often produced government informers who leaked information to newspapers on their own initiative. Watergate seemed to be the exception. No dissatisfied FBI agent or CRP employee had ever come to Bernstein or Woodward offering information. The closest they had come to observing one of these legendary fountains of information had been about a week after the indictments were handed down. The caller had said she worked for the Department of Justice and had seen files showing that Jeb Magruder and Bart Porter had lied to the grand jury, along with others. The persons in charge of the investigation had known they lied, and unusual political pressures had been brought to bear on the investigation throughout, particularly from the White House, she said. But the reporters couldn't keep her on the phone. She was too frightened, and they never heard from her again.